Please be seated, everyone, and we'll go ahead and call our next case, which is case number 62061, Susan Marion, Wendy Marion versus Michael and Wendy Greenberg Family Trust. We have Mr. Wall here representing the appellants, Mr. Mazzica representing the respondent. You can see me by video. We have Justice Hardesty in Carson City in the courtroom right now, and he will be participating in our arguments through video. We'll try and take a Ninth Circuit approach to these and see how it works and like that. And Justice Sata is not here today, but she will also be listening to the podcast of the oral argument and will be participating in the decision of this case. So, Mr. Wall, you may proceed. One opening comment we'd like to make is the court published an opinion last Thursday, it was on May 29th, called Labby versus District Court. I'm going to invite the attorney, I don't know if you've all had a chance to look at that, but to see if that might have any implications on this case today. So if either side wishes to address that, please feel free to do so. Mr. Wall, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Gibbons and Associate Justices, we thank you for the opportunity of being here. I'd like to reserve about 3 minutes of my time if I can. I have with me Cammie Perkins, who is trial counsel and lots of counsel at Hutchison and Stephan, and Lucas in the courtroom, Ron Leonard and Susan Martin in the first row there. I want to begin with the Labby case, because the Labby case resolves many of the issues in this case. In many ways, the Labby case is identical to this case. And so that would be a good beginning point. I would say that there are two things about this case that are different from the Labby case. The first of those would be that the non-judicial foreclosure sale in this case was in Arizona rather than a foreclosure sale in the state of Nevada. That's a difference which opposing counsel has made a big deal about in the briefs, but it's a difference that I think really is a distinction without a difference, and a difference that this court should resolve in favor of finding that it doesn't matter where the foreclosure sale takes place, because the location of the real property has nothing to do with the public policies that we're here to discuss. The second thing that is different about this case is that in the Labby case, the complaint itself had deficiency language and sought a deficiency. In this case, that's not true. The complaint in this case, which was filed before the foreclosure in Arizona, has no language suggesting that the plaintiff was seeking a deficiency of any kind or pursuing that kind of a claim. So I would suggest that this case is a stronger case for finding that there should be an obligation of complying with the anti-deficiency statutes than there was in Labby. The public policy of this state, as I understand it, has got to be that in a foreclosure situation, in a lender situation, there needs to be full satisfaction of the debt for the lender. But there has to be protection for the debtors from double recoveries from the lender. And that's precisely what was attempted in this case. I understand the way that it came out eventually was that anti-deficiency protections were given to the Martians at the trial, but that's not how the case began, and that's not how it got to the trial that it got to. Opposing counsel or the plaintiffs in this matter, the Greenbergs, what they sought from the beginning, what they sought throughout the underlying action was they wanted to sell the property, which they did in Arizona, purchased it for $38,000, although it had an appraised value of $2.5 million at that time. They wanted to keep that property and they wanted to recover the entire amount of the debt from the guarantors in Nevada. That's what they always sought. Now, it turned out that Judge Sterling was not willing to allow them to do that, so she did at least apply the standard for determining what the deficiency was when they got to trial. But the argument that we hear over and over from opposing counsel that we got what we wanted and that what happened was that the protections were there would be the same thing as if you were to convict a person without filing an indictment against them or a criminal complaint or commence an action without filing a complaint and deny a motion to dismiss and force it to a trial. What we have here is a statute of limitations that requires an application. That application is necessary to a deficiency, and there was no application. It's not that there wasn't a timely application for a deficiency. There was never an application for a deficiency. And even at the last hearing, the plaintiffs were arguing they didn't need to seek a deficiency. Instead, they were seeking a judgment on the entire amount of the what was due. Opposing counsel has focused most of his attention in his briefs on the one-action rule and the waiver of the one-action rule. This isn't a one-action rule case. We understand that they could bring multiple actions. In fact, for the first time in the answering brief, they argued that that there's a statute, subsection of the statute, that would preclude the one-action rule from applying to a foreclosure in another state. And that's true. They can have as many actions as they want to have, because we waived the one-action rule. But what was waived was NRS 40.430, the one-action rule. We did not waive the anti-deficiency statutes. The anti-deficiency statutes are in a separate section, labeled anti-deficiency statutes, from the one-action rule, which is labeled foreclosure actions. And that's been a red herring argument throughout, that they, because they have
separate... Mr. Law, let me ask you this, because I guess it's somewhat difficult for both counsel, because the case just came out, and ironically this argument set the following week, so neither one of you had a chance to brief it yet as of now, but I anticipate counsel's going to argue that if the court really conducted the hearing like it was a deficiency hearing and allowed the fair market value offset, what's the harm here in this situation? Didn't your clients get a full opportunity to assert their defenses in front of the district court? What's your thoughts on that?
One of the defenses that they had in the district court was that they were entitled to an application for a deficiency before they went to that point. And there was a hearing, but there was not the procedural protections of the deficiency statute were not there. They didn't get the notice at the time that they should have gotten the notice. And I understand that in the dissent, it was argued on the Nevis case, that the Nevis case suggests that that if it's a procedural requirement that the court can overlook it. But Nevis case doesn't say that at all. What the Nevis case did not do was apply Shields retroactively to require a procedure to be followed that had not been followed because it wasn't required before Shields. The procedure...
Why isn't that this case with Lavi just coming down?
This wouldn't be a retroactive application of Lavi in this case because the obligation to file an application is statutory and already existed. In Shields, the obligation didn't exist at all. They couldn't have complied with it. In this case, they should have complied with it. There should have been an application, and there was not an application. And that is a statute of limitations, and you could make that exact same argument in any case where a statute of limitations has been missed and has been raised as a defense. And the court has said, no, I'm not going to do that. We're going to proceed to a trial. And you proceed to a trial, and you can say, well, you got a trial. You would have had a trial if they'd come before the statute of limitations ran. They didn't meet the statute of limitations in this case, which was the obligation under the statute, which protects both lender and borrower, because the lender has to commence an action for a deficiency, puts the borrower on notice that there's an action for a deficiency, and that is jurisdictional. And the Lavi court said that waiving the one-action rule doesn't waive that protection. That's been the argument all along. Waiving the one-action rule doesn't waive that protection, but this court said that BB&T's interpretation that waiving the one-action rule also frees an obligee from complying with the provisions of NRS 40.455 is unreasonable. And that's what we believe is the case here, that it's unreasonable, that that's a statute of limitations. And so the only real argument that they have with respect to the, that is left over, that is not resolved by Lavi against the plaintiffs in this case, is that the foreclosure was in Arizona.
Do you read Lavi to say that none of the protections in 451 to 459 can be waived by a guarantor?
I believe that that's exactly what Lavi says.
And so today, on a post-2011 transaction, a lender who makes a loan that's guaranteed who wants to sell that loan will not be able to sell that loan and enforce the guarantees for less than what the acquirer of the loan pays under the new 459, right?
Well, under 459, you can only if the legislature wanted you to be able to waive the protections, the other protections, it would have said so. It says that you can only waive, and it uses the statute by number. The one action waived by number. It doesn't say you waive the one action rule. It says you waive the protections of 430. And so that's correct. Borrowers are not allowed in this state because of the statutes to waive certain fundamental rights.
But guarantors, by your reading of them, are not either in the
450. By my reading of that and my reading of Shields, can only waive what the statute allows them to waive, and that's the one action rule, and that's what was waived here. But they can't waive those other protections. All of those protections apply for them.
Mr. Bell, let me ask you this. I'm looking at the order of October 17, 2012. Was there any discussion in the district court of the case of Walters versus district court and any analysis by the district court done to your knowledge?
Walters came late.
I can't remember the date it came. That's what it was.
Walters came late. We did address Walters at the very end before the district court went. That would have been in the last hearings. And we basically made the same arguments there that were made in briefs here, that Walters says exactly what it says, that there has to be a separate notice. And, of course, Walters was ambiguous on that point. It was difficult for us to know exactly what Walters said, and we argued here. We argue that Walters stands for that proposition that there has to be a separate application. And there was a separate application in Walters, and it was... There were several separate applications. At least the summary judgment was considered to be sufficient. In this case, not only is that summary judgment come before, and this court has declared that if it comes before, it can't give notice. Of course it can't give notice. How does it give notice that the creditor is going through an additional remedy when that didn't even exist at the time the complaint was done, and that's stated in the majority opinion?
Well, Mr. Wall, if I could interrupt you, the way I read the order of the judge on April 12, 2012, the judge says at 204 of the record, the court finds no substantial change in the law and no particular guidance by the Nevada Supreme Court's decision in Walters versus 8th District relative to the facts of this case to overrule the court's prior decision in this matter. Was that the district court's analysis of that case, as the chief inquired?
It was in this sense. What happened there was that Judge Gonzalez had already determined that there was a vacuum in the law. So that there was no statute of limitations, there was no Nevada law, there was no Arizona law. The judge had decided there was a vacuum in the law, and we brought a second motion, which was a motion for summary judgment, which Judge Sherman treated as a motion for reconsideration. And so in that one, we did argue that Walters showed that was a change in the law, and Judge Sherman said she didn't see Walters as being a change in the law, and therefore we could not, she didn't get to the merits, she just said that it was a motion for reconsideration that was denied.
Okay. Mr. Walters, you want to reserve the balance of your time? You have almost 3 minutes.
I did, Your Honor, but there's a point that I want to make, and I'm my time to make it. And that point is that we need to, the statute that they're relying on, so that they say it doesn't apply to this state, is NRS 454, which requires a plaintiff to file a separate application within 6 months after the date of the foreclosure sale or the trustee sale held pursuant to NRS 107.080, respectively. So it's either one of those. The way that statute is written, I would suggest it's supposed to be broadly inclusive, not narrow, to narrow the actions to which it would apply. It can be a foreclosure or a trustee sale. This court, I admit that there's ambiguity in the statute, but if you read that statute narrowly, as opposing counsel would read it, it defeats those public policies that I talked about, of not allowing a double recovery.
Yeah,
if you read it broadly, it does both.
Your guarantee agreement had a Nevada choice of law clause as well, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I will reserve the rest of my time.
Yes, and we'll give you 3 minutes, so I'll give Mr. Mazzeca an additional minute and a half to even the timeout, so you have six. We can't do half minutes, I'm sorry. Why don't you take 17 minutes, and then I'll give Mr. Wall 4 minutes, so go ahead.
I don't know if I have 17 minutes. Good morning, Your Honor. Thomas V. Mazzeca and Matthew Peary on behalf of respondent plaintiffs. I'd simply like to inform the court that today is Mr. Peary's birthday.
We wish him happy birthday.
We're not requesting any deference to that. First off, I would like to respectfully disagree with the nature of what happened. I was trial counsel and primary counsel during the entire case. At no time after that foreclosure, there was a foreclosure and there was a complaint filed in March of 2009. 1 month later, in Arizona, there was a trustee sale. After that time, it took a while. We had issues with getting them served. They made an appearance in the case. Once they appeared in the case, at no time did we ever pursue the entirety of the guarantee. The complaint, for relief, said damages according to trial, proved at trial. So we were treating this as an issue of damages. And
what damages did you seek the difference between the amount you bid in on the land of $38,000 plus what was owed on the note?
The damages would be the amount due on the guarantee plus the interest, whatever.
Right.
Less the fair market value.
It wasn't $38,000, it was whatever the fair market value was.
Okay. And we went the entire case after those motions was based on the sole issue. There were no motions made or needed to be made on liability. Nobody was contesting liability. No one was contesting the guarantee. The only issue before all of us was, what is the fair market value? The case was tried at bench 2 days, completely and thoroughly, because it's a complex issue. This is desert land out in Arizona that was being hopefully developed for massive amount of homes. But then the Great Recession struck, and the big issue is, what is the value of that land? Because the testimony was, despite what all the appraisers said, the numbers are all over the place, is you couldn't give it away. Right? So it was a question. But the court made a finding of fact, decided using all the appraisals that it had a value of $350,000, subtracted that from the guarantee, and entered its judgment. Right. Justice Gibbons, you issued a good point, because basically what you're saying is, all right, you didn't get an application. What's the prejudice? There was no prejudice, right? They didn't get an application, all right? They didn't get that piece of paper.
Now, the lawsuit, it predated the foreclosure proceeding, didn't it?
By 1 month, the lawsuit.
Well, here's my question. Again, you're getting Labby, you know, with the week's notice, but in Labby, the dissent argued that if you filed the lawsuit before the foreclosure takes place, but basically make allegations for these damages and all that should be sufficient, you know, and you shouldn't have to amend and to file this application within 6 months. The majority said, no, you have to file it within 6 months. You have to amend even if you have a pre-existing lawsuit. So how would you argue the facts of this case here that you feel that your client's in compliance with Labby?
The differences are not monumental. One, we're not a lending institution. This was an individual, a trust, a family trust that made the loan. And we went all the way through, and we in fact had a trial which was tantamount to being a deficiency hearing. Now, I have in detail read the Labby decision, which was issued on Thursday. I believe the ink is still wet. And obviously made for a good weekend for me. I would like to say at this point, by the way, that Justice Pickering's dissent, joined by Justice Hardesty, is written much, much, much better than our respondent brief, and I'm embarrassed. It is thorough. It is compelling. Perhaps not compelling enough, but it argues most of the points we argued in a much better fashion. Mm-hmm. I almost want to adopt it here. But before I do that, because of Lavi, I want to talk about our strongest issue now. And our strongest issue is the fact that the foreclosure, deed of trust sale, was in Arizona. Right. And the statute specifically says that if the deed of trust sale is pursuant to Nevada law. Now, the word respectfully used in that statute basically means the difference in time. The time between the foreclosure, right? Let me get that wording up here. Oh, I'm sorry. Because I'm looking at the wrong statute. I thought you recorded that. My first time here, I'm a little more nervous than I should be. The date between the 6 months, the statute requires that the notice be 6 months from the date of the foreclosure or the trustee sale pursuant to Nevada statutes. That's what the respectively is talking about, between those two dates. Right. Now, the statute could have said, or similar statute from another state, or similar statute from another jurisdiction. It did not. This court, I have to quote in part, this court from the Walters case, where the court said, when the language of the statute is plain and unambiguous, the courts are not permitted to search for meaning beyond the statute itself. The public should be able to rely on the plain language of statutes. The statute here says a deed of trust sale pursuant to Nevada law happened in Arizona.
But didn't you select Nevada law under your contracting documents to apply for the choice of law issue?
For the contract, yes. And we're choosing Nevada law. So I'm reading Nevada law. So this statute selected by the parties is a Nevada statute that says you should be using a trustee sale that occurred pursuant to Nevada law. Mm-hmm. The trustee sale did not occur pursuant to Nevada law. It pursued to Arizona law. Now, there's been discussions about the similarity between the two states. However, for consistency, what if this was in Louisiana? What if the foreclosure had been in Louisiana or Connecticut or Mexico? The same arguments need to apply here, right?
So your argument is if the real estate's in another state, you have to apply the law of that state to the whole foreclosure proceeding, including obligations under the note and guarantee.
My argument, Your Honor, is that and that the statute is not clear on that point. It specifically clearly states that the requirement is based on a deed of trust sale that was done pursuant to Nevada law, and that did not appear here.
But it has an alternative. It says foreclosure sale or deed of trust sale pursuant to whatever 107.080. So why would not that? It's a two-part question. It seems to me that foreclosure sale in that statute would authorize looking at the Arizona law statute, the foreclosure, and then applying Nevada law. Your contract said Nevada law applies. The restatement of conflict says when you have a piece of property, one close securing a debt and a note in the form, that you follow the law of the note and the guarantee on the enforceability of the note and the anti-deficiency pieces of it. So it seems to me that's a very tough argument, given that the statute's an alternative. It says foreclosure sale or deed of trust sale pursuant to.
Your Honor, that's important because, this was not a foreclosure sale in Arizona. It was a sale pursuant to deed of trust. If foreclosure settlement deed of trust. Why did they say deed of trust again?
Perhaps because other states refer to this differently.
Perhaps. We don't know that. What we do have before us is a specific statement limiting it to a procedure that occurred pursuant to Nevada law. In support of that, in NRS Statute 4430, paragraph 6C, it excludes, and this has been discussed, excludes from the definition of action actions to enforce mortgages on property that is outside of the state which do not result in personal judgments against the debtor, which is what happened here. There was no personal judgment against the debtor. So the statute suggests that it is not addressing property when the property is outside of the state of Nevada. This is actually a jurisdiction issue. Because in paragraph 1 of NRS 4430, it states, the court, by its decree or judgment, may direct a sale of the encumbered property. How does a Nevada court direct a sale on encumbered property that's located in Arizona, Louisiana, Mexico? It can't. This statute was not written to address property outside of Nevada. The statute was written to address property solely existing in Nevada. It is not the court's place to rewrite the statute to provide, to create provisions that address how do we deal with out-of-state property. That is the legislature's province to do.
So what law would be applied to this case if we agreed with that?
We're still applying Nevada law. I'm interpreting a Nevada statute. All right. So all I am saying is that we've chosen the law of Nevada. Okay, what does the law of Nevada say? Here's the statute. What does the statute say? We don't have to do a notice of deficiency if it's not a foreclosure or a deed of trust sale in Nevada. That is following the law in Nevada, pursuant to the guarantee agreement. Okay. Very quickly, I'd like to move to the more troublesome problem. I have read the Roddy decision, and I know I have an uphill battle here because the dissent is argued so well. So I want to focus on a couple of points, all right, that may sway two more of you in our direction.
Good luck.
I know. I can tell by the paper that it was a hotly debated issue and not taken lightly. Not to assume that you ever take anything lightly, but no stone went unturned. But here's a couple stones that I think are applicable here that have been touched on but not really focused on. NRS 4300 says, unless there has been a waiver pursuant to NRS 4495, there can be but one action. That action must be in accordance with the provisions of NRS 4430 through 4459. That action. It did not say those actions. It did not say any action. It said that action. So our position is that the Martins did not waive 455. 455 is not applicable. It's not a waiver issue, it's an applicability issue. Because the way the statute is worded, again, the plain language, right? That, why did it say that action? It has to have some sort of meaning. You say it's one action unless you have a waiver. That action must proceed as to these sections. Impliedly then, the 495 doesn't pursue it to that paragraph. All right, so it's not a waiver issue, it's an applicability issue. Then there was a concern, you say, well, what would happen? Would that mean that you could have actually a windfall? I would argue that at that point in time, there was a loophole. a loophole in the statute. We've seen loopholes before. Federal laws constantly have loopholes. This was a loophole that my clients had nothing advantage of, because my clients, because of the loophole, may have been able to pursue the entire amount, plus the value of the property. They didn't. They pursued a fair and reasonable outcome, because I believe that if you pursue a fair and reasonable outcome, it greatly increases the likelihood of prevailing. All right. That's my train of thought there. So, the loophole was filled. That's the important part here, because if the court denies the appeal, it does not open the floodgates to actions for redundant recoveries. Because, as I said before, the legislature has a role here. It has amended 495, added Section 4. And Section 4, which is outside of these statutes that are in 430, that when I said that statute, 495 is outside of them, and it now says what you have to do if you have a waiver. And what does 495-4 say? It's a clarification. I know it comes after our action, after our procedures, but it's a clarification. It's not really a change in the law. It's because of this question, because of this loophole. It is saying if you have a waiver, then you shall, if the complaint is filed first, you shall have a fair market hearing. If there is a foreclosure afterwards, you should have that hearing. Everything that we did is in Section 4. The only difference is they use the time frame of the filing of the complaint for the fair market value instead of the sale of the deed of trust. In our case, it's 1 month apart. It's the same thing. Right. So there is no concern here that people who have waivers will not be able to pursue double recoveries. The legislature has repaired that. Very quickly, I believe the Shields case in 1986 resulted in the statute of 1987, Section 495. Paragraph 3 of Section 495 is the portion being relied on. But it's basically just codifying Shields, saying if a borrower has rights, as in vicious rights, so does the guarantor, if applicable. It's not demanding that those rights must happen in this waiver situation, only if applicable.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Wall, you'll have 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The seeds of destruction of counsel's argument with respect to the construction of the statute are in his own argument. And this is an argument that he makes for the first time on appeal, and he spent a lot of his brief on it. It's the argument based on NRS 40.436, which he misreads to say that all of the statutes don't apply, all of the deficiency statutes don't apply if the property is in a different state, and that's not what it says. And NRS 436, which is an argument he makes for the first time, recognizes that there can be more than one action in certain circumstances. In other words, it's a list of things that are exceptions to the one action rule. It's in the one action rule itself. And the exception that is made there is that if the property is in another state, there might have to be more than one action. That's why the statute says that you may direct a sale. The district court certainly cannot cause a sale in another state, but he certainly could direct the parties that it has personal jurisdiction over before it to conduct a sale before it allows them to have a deficiency judgment. And in those actions that were already recognized where you had, because the property is in another state, the statute specifically recognizes there might be more than one action. It doesn't say the anti-deficiency statutes don't apply. Counsel says that I misrepresented the record and that they never said that they didn't want a deficiency. It's not exactly true. If you read all the way through, they have argued in every single pleading and in every single hearing that because the one action rule was waived, all of the anti-deficiency statutes that existed at that time were waived. Subsection 4 didn't exist at that time of 495. That's been my argument. If you waive all of those anti-deficiency statutes, all of them, you don't pick and choose which ones you're waiving. The argument is they didn't have to do a deficiency. The judge required them to do a deficiency hearing anyway, but their argument was always that all of the deficiency statutes do not apply. Let's read the statute correctly and as it is written. If I can find it. It says that the plaintiff has to file a separate application for a deficiency judgment within 6 months after the date of the foreclosure sale or the trustee's sale held pursuant to NRS 107, respectively. Respectively has no meaning in that statute unless the or means that these things are in the alternative to each other. Any foreclosure sale would trigger the deficiency protections, and it doesn't really make any difference where the property is. Now, one thing that you didn't hear from opposing counsel, and you won't hear from opposing counsel, is a policy argument as to why you should read that statute so narrowly that it would only provide protections in a trustee sale brought pursuant to Chapter 107 or a foreclosure sale inside the state of Nevada. Because if you read it that way, it would mean that any sale in any other state, there are no protections, whether this plaintiff sought a double recovery or not. That ruling opens the floodgates and the doors to a double recovery because the statute doesn't apply. And it's not simply solved by subsection 4. This court considered that, and with respect, Justice Pickering, this court decided that there's not such a thing as a one action. That action doesn't refer to a one action. That action refers to any action that is authorized by that by a statute which itself recognizes the possibility of multiple actions, especially when one of those actions is because the property is in a different state. There's no public policy served by saying that we don't protect the debtor in this state. It says in his, it was said in their very first document, and they repeated it multiple times. This is what they say. The deficiency judgment statutes in Nevada primarily concern debt protection for real property in Nevada, not Arizona. I beg to differ.
Okay, Mr. Ball, I think you're out of time. Thank you very much for your argument. Excellent argument. Thank you both for kind of thinking on your feet here. I know we spun the surprise program on all of you, but that happens, you know, as cases evolve, but there are other cases pending may have similar issues and all like that. So we appreciate your quick response to those issues. So the case will stand submitted, and we'll be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.